Lecture 22, Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse 5, Apocalypse Now.
Let me begin this lecture on Slaughterhouse 5 by referring briefly to the Vonnegut career. He began writing in the 1950s and published essentially sci-fi kinds of books that are marked by a very weird tone that we associate now with him. They're wacky, they're wry, they're goofball, and yet they're also melancholy and fatalistic. We know that Vonnegut himself experienced considerable despair in his life. His parents, he has told us, were essentially destroyed by the Depression. I quote him, "I learned a bone-deep sadness from them." And accidents happened to him of the sort that we see in his books, that his sister died, and within 24 hours later, her husband was killed in an automobile accident, and the three children, in fact, were taken in by Vonnegut. So that the kinds of weird coincidences and often the kind of bone-crushing disasters that happen in his books are something that he knows firsthand. The book that I'm talking about is, I think, the only book of his that really is going to stand, and that's Slaughterhouse 5. It was published in 1969. In it, he became immediately the spokesperson for a generation, that and was invited for the remaining decade to campuses all over the United States to speak, like Catch 22 or like The Catcher in the Rye. This was a lightning rod text, and it sort of really, I think, was a kind of consummate expression for much that people were experiencing in the 60s. It appeared at the height of the Vietnam War, and it really captured the turmoil of that age, caught the spirit. And I think it really passed into the language, that the phrase that sort of is the choral refrain in Slaughterhouse 5, "so it goes," as you may remember, it's a phrase that accompanies every mention of death within that text. And Vonnegut has fun with it as well, not only when people die, but if a bottle of champagne is opened and it's flat, so it's dead champagne, he'll say, "so it goes." If he's talking about the death of the novel, he'll also say, "so it goes." Nonetheless, that became a kind of slogan that people used in the 70s. Now, this is fairly astounding in some sense, because it's not often that one sees a novel that is at once radically experimental and also a bestseller. And that's the case for this book. That it's a book that is very, very sort of down to earth. It, like most of Vonnegut's work, seems to promote middle class values. It's written in extremely clear language, even simple, even simplistic language. It has little ditties in it. It has little childlike drawings in it, like so much of his work. But it captures the absurdity of that moment. Now, what happens is, I said earlier that this is the book, I think, that's going to stand to Vonnegut's, because the criticism, particularly in the academy, starts to mount. And I'd say within a decade, by the end of the 70s, people are not taking Vonnegut seriously in the university. You begin to hear that Vonnegut is fuzzy, he's sentimental, he's facile, he's superficial, he's simplistic. And now, as we approach the end of the century, the career begins to come back in terms of reputation. People begin to take another interest in his work. But I think that even when the dust sort of settles, it will still be Slaughterhouse 5 that looks like a masterpiece. Why did he write this book about Dresden in the way he did? Well, Vonnegut was there. He experienced the firebombing at Dresden, and he offers us some of the numbers about Dresden, just so that you know what this city means to him and what the importance of it is. One line that I'll cite, which is what he was told in the war when, as a prisoner of war, he's being transferred to Dresden, is, "You needn't worry about bombs, by the way. Dresden is an open city. It is undefended and contains no war industries or troop concentrations of any importance." But it was bombed. And many will claim that it is arguably the single worst event of World War II. That 135,000 people were killed in a civilian bombing, firebombing. And Vonnegut cites that even in the incendiary bombs at Tokyo, there were only 84,000 killed and only 71,000 in Hiroshima. Now, I don't know if he's got his numbers right, but he's trying to make the argument that this, in a sense, dwarfs all of the other atrocities of World War II, and yet no one talks about Dresden. And he's not investigating this out of curiosity. He lived it. He was there. This book includes him as a first-person speaker as well. He tells us on page 11, I wrote the Air Force back then asking for details about the raid on Dresden. Who ordered it? How many planes did it? Why they did it? What desirable results there had been and so on. I was answered by a man who, like myself, was in public relations. He said that he was sorry, but that the information was top secret still. I read the letter out loud to my wife. I said, secret? My God, from whom? Now, this city and this bombing sit inside of Vonnegut, and the book shows us not only what that event was like, but it speaks of the difficulty of getting this story out in the open. And in fact, one of the crazier episodes of the book is late in the book when Billy Pilgrim, who is the protagonist that Vonnegut creates, is in the hospital. It so happens that he is next to this old, very grizzled war historian, one of these Boston Brahmin types, who is convinced that nothing really important happened at Dresden. And you've got this interesting kind of debate between the two of them. Billy keeps trying to say, I was there. And this other man just doesn't want to hear it, that he himself has written histories of the war and is convinced that, Dresden doesn't require further mention. What is the relationship of Billy himself to Dresden? Dresden itself as a city is evoked in this text. And it's evoked, I think, with a certain amount of pathos, that Billy has never seen anything like it. The Americans arrived in Dresden at 5 in the afternoon. The boxcar doors were open because he's being transported there as a prisoner of war. And the doorways framed the loveliest city that most of the Americans had ever seen. The skyline was intricate and voluptuous and enchanted and absurd. It looked like a Sunday school picture of heaven to Billy Pilgrim. And then, in characteristic fashion, the next paragraph goes like this. Somebody behind him in the boxcar said, Oz. That was I. That was me. The only other city I'd ever seen was Indianapolis, Indiana. So there's Vonnegut entering into his text. Lets Billy describe it as heaven. He then comes in and adds, I think it was Oz. But you get a sense of the magic of this city before, of course, it was destroyed. Now, Vonnegut was there. But this book appears in 1969. Why does it take so long to write this story? And he tells us about that. He says that he had this story in him but didn't know how to tell it. Now, we've seen this. You remember from the Hemingway text about Harold Krebs, who comes home from the war and can't find words to speak his experience and feels that everything he says about what he encountered in the war is a lie. It distorts. It cheats. And Hemingway himself was concerned about these matters. Vonnegut was trying to find out if there could be a way to articulate this experience that would be commensurate with the experience. He reminds me, there's a very famous, well, I don't know if it's famous, but it's an important analog to this. The writer who got the Nobel Prize about 8 or 10 years ago, Claude Simon, a French writer, had almost the same experience. He had been a prisoner of war in World War II and also lived with that experience for about 2 decades before, or at least 15 years, before he could find the language in his great book, The Flanders Road, La Route de Flandre, where he found, sort of wrote the whole book as one long extended sentence about his experiences in the war. And there are a lot of parallels between The Flanders Road and Slaughterhouse Five. How could you say it? How could you find the right language? This is not a new concern for us. I mentioned Hemingway, but you could go all the way back to to earlier books like The Red Badge of Courage or Stendhal's Charterhouse of Parma about the challenge for any writer, prose writer, to deliver war. What would be the right narrative frame for it? And Hemingway is a good reference as well because In Our Time, which is the text that we read, it really is, I think, an appropriate phrase for understanding Vonnegut's evocation of Dresden. that this city that was firebombed back at the end of World War II has unmistakable parallels with what Vonnegut is experiencing in the 1960s in the United States. So we have a passage like this. This is his character, Billy Pilgrim, in his car. He was stopped by a signal in the middle of Ilium's black ghetto. The people who lived here hated it so much that they had burned down a lot of it a month before. It was all they had, and they'd wrecked it. The neighborhood reminded Billy of some of the towns he had seen in the war. The curbs and sidewalks were crushed in many places, showing where the National Guard tanks and half-tracks had been. So you begin to realize that this story is not just an effort to somehow recapture this devastating moment of the past, but it's also an effort to interweave it with a story that's still unfurling, that is about contemporary America. And I think this is not unrelated to the success of this book. That people, if they had just thought this was a book about Dresden, as interesting as Dresden was, it would not have touched the nerve that it did. But it's a book about what was happening in America as well. So it's not an accident that Billy, the protagonist who's been to Dresden, his son is becoming a Green Beret in this text. And there are descriptions that are unmistakably about Vietnam, but again couched in Vonnegut's inimitable fashion. He tells us about a science fiction novel, The Gutless Wonder, written about a robot, and Vonnegut has this inimitable style, a robot who had bad breath, who became popular after his halitosis was cured. All right. However, what's important about this robot is that it predicted the widespread use of burning jellied gasoline on human beings. It was dropped on them from airplanes. Robots did the dropping. You begin to see the pieces coming together here. Robots did the dropping. They had no conscience and no circuits which would allow them to imagine what was happening to the people on the ground. The pieces are there. This is the sci-fi motif, the robots, etc., the sort of thing that's in Star Wars. And we see it linked up to an ongoing story at the moment that he's writing this of napalm being dropped in Vietnam, and all of this as a kind of analog to the story that he wants to tell about Dresden. So this is in our time, and it's about war as a kind of continuum, as a kind of ongoing phase of human experience. I mentioned Harold Krebs. I wanted to sort of spell out the general Hemingway suspicion of the big words of talking about war in such a way as to dress it up, to inflate it, to make it look like a kind of dignified enterprise. Vonnegut is absolutely coming out of that same worry and that same concern. It concerns his integrity as a writer, and it concerns his sense of being honest about his own experience. What can you say about a massacre? That's a phrase in the book. What can you say about a massacre? What language would possibly be commensurate or adequate to it? Well, science fiction is one of the ways in which this gets worked out. And so we have, for example, efforts to describe what Dresden looked like after the war in terms of a moon landing or a moon exploration. And it's interesting. I'll read you the way Vonnegut gets to that. There was a firestorm out there. Dresden was one big flame. The one flame ate everything organic, everything that would burn. It wasn't safe to come out of the shelter until noon the next day. When the Americans and their guards did come out, the sky was black with smoke. As you know, almost everybody was killed. The reason that Vonnegut survived, and Billy Pilgrim and the text dies, that they were locked in this meat locker, Slaughterhouse 5, well under the ground, and therefore miraculously preserved. The sun was an angry little pinhead. Dresden was like the moon now, nothing but minerals. The stones were hot. Everybody else in the neighborhood was dead. So it goes. And we watched this moon reference. It was like the moon, said Billy Pilgrim. And then we read about the Americans forming in ranks of four as they walk. It was realized that there was no food or water, and that the survivors, if they were going to continue to survive, were going to have to climb over curve after curve on the face of the moon. And the next paragraph, nobody talked much as the expedition crossed the moon. And you've literally moved into a kind of science fiction model again. And yet it seems rigorously appropriate for describing this utterly destroyed and transformed city that had been Oz, that had been a picture of heaven for this American boy. Now it's a lunar landscape. What can you say about a massacre? The birds have their reaction to it. He tells us that at the earliest part of the book. What do the birds say? All there is to say about a massacre. Things like, pooty-tweet. That's what you could say about a massacre. And after that reference to the bird language, pooty-tweet, he says, I have told my sons that they are not under any circumstances to take part in massacres, and that the news of massacres of enemies is not to fill them with satisfaction or glee. That's the kind of Vonnegut dry wit. Massacres are not nice. It's better not to be part of them. Pooty-tweet. Moons. The book starts with a wonderful set of conversations about Vonnegut's writer's block, about how to tell this story, how to unload this story. And he calls up, he makes calls, he tells us he gets drunk at night, and he makes calls to his former war buddies, and his mouth, his terrible breath, mustard, he says mustard gas and roses. And he tries to get people to talk to him about the war. And finally he visits his old buddy O'Hare, who was with him in Dresden, and he realizes that O'Hare's wife is furious. She's just staring at them. And she won't say why. And finally, after they're sitting there boozing together and they're trying to sort of unlock their memories, finally he sort of asks her, what is it you have against me? And she looks at him head on and she said, you were just babies then. What? I said. You were just babies in the war. Like the ones upstairs. Because they have children that are upstairs. I nodded that this was true. We had been foolish virgins in the war right at the end of childhood. But you're not going to write it that way, are you? This wasn't a question, he writes. This was an accusation. Well, I don't know, because he hasn't figured out how he's going to write it. She said, well, I know. You're going to pretend you were men instead of babies, and you'll be played in the movies by Frank Sinatra and John Wayne and some of those other glamorous, war-loving, dirty old men. And war will look wonderful, and we'll have a lot more of them, and they'll be fought by babies, like the babies upstairs. So he raises up his right hand, and he says, Mary, I don't think this book of mine is ever going to be finished. I must have written 5,000 pages by now and thrown them all away. But if I ever do finish it, I give you my word of honor, there won't be a part for Frank Sinatra or John Wayne. I'll call it the Children's Crusade. And that is the subtitle of the book, Children's Crusade. And so this is different from Hemingway. This is different from Stephen Crane. This is an effort to tell the war really from the perspective that is that of a child, or perhaps that of an alien, that of a Martian. We're going to see that of a Tripholmadorian. There's lots of ways that Vonnegut is going to try to bring innocence to this narration of destruction. The Crusades is a particular reference that's important because we realize that that's the way war has often been depicted. The Children's Crusade, as you may know, was a real crusade. The children were enlisted in the Crusades. And Vonnegut gives us two versions of how crusades can be characterized. History, this is going back from mid-19th century history. History in her solemn page informs us that the crusaders were but ignorant and savage men, that their motives were those of bigotry, unmitigated, and that their pathway was one of blood and tears. All right, that's the Crusades unmasked, Crusades as really filth and dirt, exploitation, blindness. Romance, on the other hand, dilates upon their piety and heroism and portrays in her most glowing and impassioned hues their virtue and magnanimity, the imperishable honor they acquired for themselves, and the great services they rendered to Christianity. That's the high road. That's the noble, idealized version of the Crusades. And those are the two choices that Vonnegut has. That idealized version is what I would like to call the Kipling attitude, the attitude of war as grand heroics, the sort of thing that Hemingway also plays with. And the text has lots of that because Vonnegut, I think, is drawn to that sort of sentimental version of things as well. And the English are the ones who epitomize that, the English officers whom the Americans meet when they're prisoners of war. He writes, they, the English, were adored by the Germans who thought they were exactly what Englishmen ought to be. They made war look stylish and reasonable and fun. They do things like they call him Yank, and they say, good show. And they promised him that Jerry was on the run. Billy Pilgrim wondered dimly who Jerry was. He'd never heard of Jerry. He knew he was supposed to be fighting Germans. Vonnegut, I think, has a particular sort of proclivity for sort of smelling sentimentalism, for smelling the kind of sweetness that covers over the horror of things. And there's a real critique and attack of romance in this book in a lot of different ways. I call it that Kipling note, but American officers are not at all free of it either. We meet this dying American officer. He calls himself Wild Bob. He says, "You one of my boys?" when he sees Billy Pilgrim. This was a man who'd lost an entire regiment, a lot of them children, actually. He's dying. He speaks wetly, cries out, "It's me, boys. It's Wild Bob." That's what he'd always wanted his troops to call him, Wild Bob. But here, the same kind of romantic rhetoric here. But the colonel imagined he was addressing his beloved troops for the last time. He told them they had nothing to be ashamed of, that there were dead Germans all over the battlefield who wished to God they'd never heard of the 451st. He said that after the war, he was going to have a regimental reunion in his hometown, which was Cody, Wyoming. He was going to barbecue whole steers. So here's the kind of Americana dimension of this thing. It's not quite in terms of good show. It's just a USA version of the same kind of rhetoric about it's a grand thing, it's a version of the Boy Scouts or the football team or the baseball team, and we'll have a nice barbecue when it's all over. As I say, Vonnegut is suspicious of this. You have characters in the whom Billy Pilgrim fights with who think of themselves as the Three Musketeers. Vonnegut has fun with that because he shows you characters eating Three Musketeers candy bars as well. But when these people are sort of awash in the same sort of soapy rhetoric about the war being heroic, the war being glamorous, the war being idealized. And in particular, this man, Roland Weary, who is this really gruesome figure that Vonnegut creates, who constantly fantasizes that he is one of the Three Musketeers with these other scouts. These are people, Americans behind the lines, before they've been caught by the Germans. And of course, these scouts couldn't care less for Roland Weary, but he entertains this extraordinary fiction. It actually, Vonnegut puts the same language, this sort of hyped up language about the Crusades, into Roland Weary's mouth. And yet, this inflated mush, which we see all over this text, is always sort of paired with a kind of violence, with vignettes of brutality, so that Roland Weary, who fantasizes about the Three Musketeers, also specializes in violence, makes Billy take a look at his special knife. How'd you like to be hit with this? I wouldn't know, said Billy. Know why that blade's triangular? No. Makes a wound that won't close up. Oh. Makes a three-sided hole in a guy. You stick an ordinary knife in a guy, makes a slit, right? The slit closes up, right? Right. Shit, what do you know? What the hell they teach you in college? She's got a special knife that's never going to, it's going to create wounds that are never going to close up. Same guy who imagines the Three Musketeers is what he's part of. And his buddy is this man, Lazaro, who has the same sort of brutality in this text, who promises revenge. And Vonnegut is marvelous at rendering these guys. People fuck with me. Jesus Christ, they ever fucking sorry. I laugh like hell. I don't care if it's a guy or a dame. President of the United States, fuck around with me. I fix him good. Well, this kind of violence, which is the underside of what war is not limited to these figures, and it's not limited to Dresden or to war. In one of the most striking remarks of the book, after Roland Weary has talked about his three-sided knife that makes a wound that won't close, Vonnegut writes that Billy, after all, had contemplated torture and hideous wounds at the beginning and the end of nearly every day of his childhood. Billy had an extremely gruesome crucifix hanging on the wall of his little bedroom in Ilium. A military surgeon would have admired the clinical fidelity of the artist's rendition of all Christ's wounds, the spear wound, the thorn wounds, the holes that were made by the iron spikes. Billy's Christ died horribly. He was pitiful. So it goes. And then you begin to realize the scale of this book, that in this sort of wacky way, Vonnegut is not only talking about Dresden and the burning cities in the 1960s and napalm in Vietnam. He's going all the way back to the earliest stories we know, and he's saying that the song hasn't changed. So it goes. So it has always gone. And we realize that this is a kind of very large-scaled, very orchestrated rendition of the violence that is culture, the violence that is history. And I think that Vonnegut perhaps hasn't been credited with that, with the ambitiousness of this book. It's not an accident that Vonnegut studied anthropology when he was at the University of Chicago. He writes in this book that his father always complained that in his books there were no enemies, because an anthropologist doesn't see things in terms of good guys and bad guys. He sees people instead doing the kinds of things that they are programmed to do, following the particular discourses of their culture. And that is the way war comes across here. People speaking the way they have been wound up to speak. The speaker at the Lions Club meeting was a major in the Marines. He said that Americans had no choice but to keep fighting in Vietnam until they achieved victory, or until the communists realized that they could not force their way of life on weak countries. He was in favor of increased bombings, of bombing North Vietnam back into the Stone Age if it refused to see reason. Vonnegut writes that not as a war protester, but as an anthropologist. That's the way this person has been trained. There's a certain note in American life that has that particular sound to it. But it's not just the war. Try to compare that phrase with this. This is Vonnegut speaking about himself, taking his girls to the World's Fair in New York. We went to New York World's Fair, saw what the past had been like, according to the Ford Motor Company and Walt Disney. Saw what the future would be like, according to General Motors. That, too, is the anthropologist speaking, showing you that, in fact, vision is always, in some sense, shaped by other strong but not necessarily visible forces, and that what we take to be our personal take on things, our personal sense of things, has, in that sense, been scripted. There is a mechanistic dimension to this book, and it happens in all kinds of places. It happens, for example, in the way this book describes sex. Here's a passage that I think gets this across. Billy was on top of Valencia making love to her. One result of this act would be the birth of Robert Pilgrim, who would become a problem in high school, but who would then straighten out as a member of the famous Green Berets. That's really a look like from Mars at the act of a man and a woman making love, about what this is going to produce. Or here's another way to examine what he's doing. Billy made a noise like a small rusty hinge. He had just emptied his seminal vesicles into Valencia, had contributed his share of the Green Beret. There, too, is a kind of discourse, a particular coded language that describes what we often think of in romantic tropes instead, of an embrace, of someone loving someone, of a moment of passion. Instead, we have an emptying of seminal vesicles that is going to ultimately eventuate into the share of a Green Beret. Character is in trouble in a book like this. The idea of an integral character. You recall that this, I'm telling you over and over in this course, that this, we're looking at the difficulty of being a self. And Vonnegut comes at it from a very strange, literally strange-making way. And therefore, he tells us that it's definitely one of the liabilities here. One of the characters that he's talking about, poor old Derby, he's the man, the older soldier, who is executed by the Germans for having stolen a tiny little thing as a prisoner of war. In referring to Derby, Vonnegut writes, "There are almost no characters in this story, and almost no dramatic confrontations, because most of the people in it are so sick and so much the listless playthings of enormous forces. One of the main effects of war, after all, is that people are discouraged from being characters." So that this book fits into our concern with the diminishing status of self, and it shows us war as one of the enormous forces that leads to that. And it's with that in mind that we want to think about how Vonnegut then is going to treat his material. And you will see that he reaches all the way to an alternate world. He will move to a different reality, to the world of Tralfamador with its peculiar rules and conventions. Thank you.